Well, I think as probably almost everyone here knows, we're kind of in the middle of our practice period, time when we intensify our practice. And we've been discussing the Vimalakirti Sutra. All the talks are online, should you have missed one of these scintillating talks. So please have a look at the website. And for those who maybe have missed some of the talks or haven't been here before, just to give you a quick introduction, the Vimalakirti Sutra is one of the earliest and most highly respected of the Mahayana sutras. And it features an unusual character, Vimalakirti, who's a layperson, not a monk or a Buddha, but a layperson who's married, has a family, knocks around the village or the town, and spreads the Dharma. He's a great Dharma teacher, and he's known particularly for his skillful means. Let's see, anything else I need to say about him? I did say he's a character, right? So the delightful thing about the Vimalakirti Sutra is that it's filled with humor and satire and kind of little jokes, but also, of course, with Dharma discourse, with teachings as well. But it makes for interesting reading, at least I think. If you haven't read the Vimalakirti Sutra, recommend it, and you can download it online for free and read it there as well. At any rate, all that information is available on our website, so please have a look if you're interested. Now tonight, although we've been talking, I think this is the seventh talk on the Vimalakirti Sutra, I'm going to jump back within the sutra itself a little bit to talk about the bodhisattvas. At the very beginning of this sutra, Vimalakirti is sick, or at least he's kind of declared himself sick. And the Buddha has then decided, okay, well, then I'll send my disciples to pay a sick call to him. And each one of them, one by one, the Buddha, you know, says, oh, now would you please go? They say, oh, I can't possibly go because, and they tell a story about how Vimalakirti kind of caught them a little bit as they were teaching the Dharma and saying, no, don't teach it like that. You should teach it like this. And giving them instruction, each one by one. They all have these stories about Vimalakirti. It's quite humorous at times. And then after he's gone through, I think, 8 or 9 of the disciples, the Buddha then turns to the bodhisattvas and says, oh, okay, now the disciples seem to can't go. Now, would you go on my behalf and pay a visit to poor Vimalakirti? Now, and that's where I'm going to pick it up. So this is early on in the sutra, but I'm picking it up from there. So here's Buddha now, talking to the bodhisattvas one by one and saying, would you please go on my behalf and speak to the Buddha, speak to Vimalakirti. And the first one he approaches is Maitreya, Bodhisattva Maitreya. You must go visit Vimalakirti and inquire about his illness. But when the Buddha asked Maitreya to be his emissary, Maitreya, who's prophesied to be the future Buddha, the next Buddha who will come into the world, Maitreya was reluctant because he too had suffered the indignity of being corrected by Vimalakirti. So right at this present moment, in case you were wondering, where is Maitreya? He resides in Tushta Heaven, according to the sutras, Tushta Heaven. And but he will be reborn here on earth at some point to teach anew the Dharma when the teachings of this present Buddha, Gautama Buddha, have completely been forgotten. And Tushta Heaven is where, at least it's said to be, where all the future Buddhas reside before the rebirth on the earth is necessary. It must be quite the place, all these people hanging out there waiting to be reborn. So here's what happened with Maitreya. So here's Maitreya in Tushta Heaven, right? talking with all the heavenly deities apparently that live there. World honored one, I am not competent to visit Vimalakirti and inquire about his illness. Why? Because I recall how once in the past I was preaching to the ruler of Tushta Heaven and his followers on the practices required to attain the state of non-returning or no longer having rebirth in samsara. So he's giving this rather sophisticated lecture, I guess, to the ruler of Tushta Heaven and the followers. And Vimalakirti happened to be wandering by. He's quite a guy. It's everywhere. And overheard Maitreya. And he then begins to question the whole idea of birth, of rebirth, right? One of the central doctrines of early the Buddhist tradition, right? By saying, "Ah, Maitreya, the world honored one prophesied that with one more birth you will be able to attain full awakening." Now, just what birth does this prophecy apply to? Does it apply to your birth in the past, your future birth, or your present birth? If it applies to a past birth, that birth has already passed. If it applies to the future birth will never arrive. It's always in the future, right? Kind of. And if it applies to the present birth, this present birth lacks any kind of permanence. It's always constantly changing. And this reminds me of this philosophical argument that you can never reach the door. Does that ring a bell? Because from here to the door, you can retrieve halfway. And then from that point to the door, you can get halfway. And then from that, you get the idea? Like you never quite reach the door. You're kind of always in these kind of halfway points. I mean, it's kind of silly, but when you think about it, you go, wait a minute. How do I get to the door? Anyway, although this section of the sutra seems to be almost kind of tossed off, I think it can give us pause to question our understanding of time as linear. Most people do not doubt their experience of time, and so they don't really understand it. Like the proverbial fish unaware of water. Is time a road that we walk on with the past always behind us? The future always ahead, and the present always moving somehow towards the future. Is that how you see time? Vimalakirti challenges Maitreya to think about the prophecy, this prophecy that Maitreya will be reborn, this prophecy of full awakening. And I think in that way challenges us to think about our common notions about time. How does the present become the past? How does the future become the present? Does it? And what truly is the present? For more on this, please read Dogen. I'll talk more about this at some point. Dogen Zenji really looks deeply at this idea of time, and very important for us to consider. So I could ask you, at what time do you practice your zazen? So Vimalakirti then continues his little lecture to Maitreya to present the ultimate unity, the oneness or non-duality of all things, which in this text is translated as suchness, right? Another very common word often used to describe that. And here are Vimalakirti's words. All living beings are part of suchness, and all other things as well are a part of suchness. The sages and worthy ones too are part of suchness. Even you, Maitreya, are part of suchness. So if you have been given a prophecy of awakening, then all living beings should likewise be given such a prophecy. You grok that? Get that, right? Everything is suchness. then of course the prophecy applies to everything. Why? Because suchness knows no dualism or differentiation. If you, Maitreya, are able to attain perfect awakening, then all living beings should likewise be able to attain it. Why? Because all living beings, in truth, bear the marks of wisdom because they are suchness. So that's kind of hard to take in, I think, with me just quickly reeling it off. But why is this important to us? Well, let me tell you the story of Dogen Zenji, the founder of this particular stream of Zen. Dogen entered the great Japanese Buddhist training center, Mount Hiei, when he was a young teenager and studied there for years, but he was unable to reconcile the prevalent teaching of original awakening or original enlightenment with Buddhist practice. In other words, if we are all originally enlightened, awakened, as the Mahayana Sutras tell us, as Vimalakirti essentially is just telling Maitreya, what everything is suchness, so of course you're awake. If that is so, if everything is originally enlightened, if we are all originally enlightened, then what's the point of our austere practice? Why are we sitting on the cushion? And this is the very question, apparently, that led him to the first Zen temple in Japan, Kenninji, where he studied, and then moving on with his teacher to China, where he wandered at various temples and studied for years before he resolved his doubt. So how did he resolve his doubt about this? Well, when Dogen returned to China, he taught what was often translated as practice realization. His view that it was awakening, rather than being the fruit of practice, is actually practice itself. That practice is itself awakening. He wrote, "To practice the way single-heartedly is itself awakening. There is no gap between practice and awakening, or zazen and daily life." I think we could say that his view is that through practice, it is through our practice that the universal and interpenetrating reality really manifests itself fully. And this is important. It's important because it helps us to finally let go of trying to be the agents of our own awakening. And when you think about it, how can that be? How can you possibly be the agent of your own awakening? I mean, we think that, don't we? If I do enough zazen and enough austere practices, I will get awakened. But that makes no sense. If I am still at the center of my practice then is still some kind of self-improvement project. The viewpoint that Vimalakirti and Dogen underscore is that the subject of practice is not the personal self. It is, in truth, all beings, everybody. That's the subject of practice. We practice with everything. One old and now deceased American Zen teacher said, "Once one thinks like a mountain, the whole world is converted. All things confirm me." Once one thinks like a mountain, the whole world is converted. All things confirm in me. There is no controller and no one to control. So So how do you do this? Well, you may try, for example, to sit outside amongst the trees and just listen. You may become like a mountain, become the sky, become the earth. Just breathe. And then what Vimalakirti says next is also extremely important, especially for us. How many of us think that at the very least we should aspire to work hard and practice the Dharma in order to attain awakening? Probably quite a few of us here. But think about it. What does awakening mean? In your heart of hearts, what do you think enlightenment or awakening is? Do you long for enlightenment because you think it will be like some, I don't know, taking a long, very long holiday on Phuket? Or some kind of horizonless, tranquil state that of just perpetual insight? Or maybe it's like an endless break, during which at long last you don't have to pay taxes, worried about loved ones, or experience any kind of discomfort. What do you imagine awakening to be? I think that's also important for us to look at so we don't get caught up in our story about awakening. So here's, in his rebuttal to Maitreya, Vimalakirti says this about awakening. He says, look, don't confuse everyone with notions that awakening is some kind of final state, a finishing of some kind, a passing through this world of samsara. He says, everything from the very beginning is just suchness, is an expression of Buddha nature, is the whole great earth, meaning the whole universe. Then Vimalakirti uses some rather poetic language to discuss awakening or bodhi. And here's some passage I'm just going to quickly paraphrase so we can do one last section here. The ground of awakening is the ultimate realm. Awakening is realization of reality. Awakening is without duality. There are no minds, no things. Awakening cannot be defined by the subjective mind. Awakening is beyond all views. Awakening is neither abandoning nor adopting. It is beyond grasping, beyond fixation. Awakening is none other than knowing everything is equal. Now, all that stuff may seem, whoa, kind of heavy duty philosophical stuff. But I don't think this is so. Dogen writes in one of his essays, to take the backward step and turn the light inward, and your body and mind of itself will drop off, your original face will appear. Very famous quote from Dogen. So through our Zazen practice, we pause the mind's normal habit of reaching out to grasp for an object of some kind. And instead, we turn the light inward to the silent mind itself, into awareness itself. And in that place, the subject and object drop away. When the mind becomes very quiet, the heart becomes still. Then the mind ceases to search for anything other than the simple experience of being alive. And the truth of those qualities of awakening that I just listed above become apparent. So there's one more really interesting story I wanted to share with you about this section of the Vimalakirti Sutra. And that's the story of Jagatindara. The Bodhisattva, he's a Bodhisattva, and his name means upholder of the age. Anyway, so Buddha says, okay, Maitreya is not going to go, you go. He says, I'm so sorry, Buddha, I can't go. I just can't go. Because I recall once when I was staying in my quiet room, at that time, King Mara appeared. Mara being the mythical kind of tempter, right? Remember, Buddha had to face Mara sitting underneath the Bodhi tree. Mara appeared, accompanied by 12,000 heavenly maidens. And he appeared in the guise of the god Indra, playing musical instruments and singing, dancing. They came to where I was. And then Mara, who I thought was Indra, and his retinue bowed their heads at my feet and pressed their palms together and stood to one side. So very kind of honorable way of presenting. Right? So here's this poor guy who he thinks the god Indra has appeared with 12,000 singing, dancing, playing musical instruments, maidens. So I thought it was Mara, and I said to him, welcome, Kaushika. Oh, I thought it was Indra, right. And Kaushika is another name for Indra. But Indra then said to me, upright one, please accept these 12,000 heavenly maidens. They can serve and wait on you. Whoa. I replied, Indra, a monk, a son of Shakyamuni, has no use for unlawful things such as these. So being a son of Buddha means, you know, celibate monk, right? Now, even in this short reply, can't you imagine Jagatindara thinking with some kind of indignation? To offer even one woman to a monk is downright offensive. And to hear you come with 12,000? And perhaps he was a little bit proudful of his ability to kind of resist temptation. Right. Now, there's a Zen story connected to this. Zen story goes like this. An old woman in China supported a monk for many years, giving him a hermitage, giving him food. And one day she wondered, well, how's his practice going? You've heard this one before, some of you. How's his practice going? So she called one of the young women from the village and asked her to enter the hermitage, quickly embrace the monk, and then ask him how he felt. So the young woman did this, and then said, how do you feel? And the monk coldly said, a withered tree on a cold boulder has no warmth in winter. And when the old woman heard this, she called out, what a fraud! Grabbed a stick, chased the monk out of the hermitage, and burnt it to the ground. How would you respond to 12,000 beautiful people being offered to you in some way? How do you respond to warmth coming forward? So let's go back to the sutra for a moment. So before I had finished speaking, Vimalakirti approached, see this guy gets around, and said to me, this is not Indra, this is only Mara who has come to trouble and vex you. And then he said to Mara, you may give these women to me. It's quite all right for me to accept them. I'm a layperson. Now, Mara was terrified of Vimalakirti, who had seen through his disguise so easily. He looked this way and that, and quickly handed over the women. Vimalakirti then addressed the women, saying, Mara has given you to me. Now it is proper that you should set your minds on attaining perfect awakening. And he expounded the Dharma to them, awakening in them a desire for the way. Then he said, Now you have conceived of the desire for the way, you may regale yourself with Dharma delight. Sounds like an ice cream, doesn't it? A Dharma delight. And they asked, what is this delight or joy? And this is what Vimalakirti said. To delight in constant faith in the Buddha, to delight in desire to hear the Dharma, to delight in giving alms, to delight in benefiting living beings, to delight in honoring and supporting teachers, to delight in practicing widespread generosity, to delight in strict observance of the precepts, to delight in patience, humility, gentleness, and harmony, to delight in meditation. To delight in bright, undefiled wisdom, to delight in broadening the mind that aspires to wisdom. That is the Dharma delight. So now, here's the good part. You thought that part was good? No, this is good. So then Mara slinks back into the room, and he wants the 12,000 heavenly maidens back. And at first, the women protest and say, wait a minute. Mara, you gave us to Vimalakirti. But then Vimalakirti says, oh, it's okay. He tells them they may return to Mara's realm and palace and there invest their time and energy in being inexhaustible Dharma lamps. And he quotes, this inexhaustible Dharma lamp is like a single lamp that lights 100 or 1,000 other lamps until the darkness is made all bright with a brightness that never ends. In this same way, sisters, one bodhisattva guides and opens a path for 100 or 1,000 living beings. Isn't that beautiful? And so clever. Another skillful means of Vimalakirti, right? Into the enemy camp. He sends 12,000 heavenly maidens to spread the Dharma. And so the women return to Mara's palace and begin to spread the Dharma. So I was thinking about this, and it's a lovely, kind of a little bit humorous story, but what I realized, what it seems to be saying to me, that instead of avoiding the painful, sleazy, sinful, materialistic kind of places we avoid, maybe a bodhisattva's practice is to be right there when necessary with wisdom and compassion. So that's all I wanted to say tonight about that chapter of the Vimalakirti Sutra. And what we'll do is, as we usually do on Wednesday nights, I'll ask you to get into small groups, and I'll put you in those groups in just a moment so we can just mix people up a little bit. And we'll talk in groups of three. Each person will get about 3 minutes. One person speaks. The other two people, please just listen carefully. Give that person your full attention. And then when that person, I'll ring the bell when the 3 minutes is over, and then the next person can go. If a person has finished speaking before the 3 minutes, that's okay just to wait in silence. And then if that person, the speaker, remembers or has something more to say, you'll please go ahead, that's fine as well. And there's no crosstalk, we just speak from our heart, we just speak what we want to say. And whatever is said in the circle, just please just let it stay well within the circle, so it's kind of a safe place for people. And I'd like you to consider this. You can talk about anything particular that I've mentioned in my talk tonight is okay, but the real question I was thinking of is what places do you avoid in your life? Places, times, people, what do you tend to avoid? Or what raises that kind of I'd like to walk on the other side of the street, or, you know, maybe if I duck under the counter, they won't see me. What things do you tend to avoid in your life? And then you can give an example. And then what would allow you to meet that place, to go to that, to be there, or to meet that person, or to whatever it is that you tend to avoid? What would perhaps help you in that place? Right? What would Vimalakirti tell you? So that's the main question. But as I said, you're welcome to talk about anything else that I've mentioned as well. There may be something Earth said earlier that rang a bell for you.